Good morning. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's a weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Today in the program, we speak with Dr. Lisa Moscone, who will tell us what we need to eat to maintain the highest and best brain function. She ought to know. She looks at hundreds of MRIs of the brain to see how different diets have affected it. Her book is called Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power.
And then we'll talk about how to micromaster something you're passionate about with Robert Twigger, who writes on that topic. He argues that we have lots of potential. We just need to learn the ways to micromaster things that we approach. It's an interesting conversation ahead. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Hi, I'm Margaret Schneider, owner of Schneider Auto Carrosserie Body and Paint. Happy to support KPCW. Located in Salt Lake City since 1984, Schneider Auto offers collision repair and restoration to pre-accident condition for most cars and light trucks. We also negotiate directly with insurance companies. Details, services, and more info at schneiderauto.net.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Our next guest is Dr. Lisa Moscone. She's the Associate Director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York and was the Director of the Nutrition and Brain Fitness Lab at NYU's School of Medicine. She's seen a brain MRI or two or several hundred in her time, and she's here to tell you that our brains, like our bodies, have very specific food requirements. She's written a book based on research from a range of specialties, including brain science and microbiome and nutritional genomics. The book is called Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Dr. Lisa Moscone.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Talk a little bit about this whole new science, neuronutrition, or it's not a new science. We've talked about nutrition for a long time, but certainly I have seen this wave recently of talking about how food will relate to the health of your brain. You know, we think about food as being something that controls our weight or it's good or bad for our organs, our heart, but it seems fairly new, and how strange that we're talking about how it relates to our brain function.
Yes, you're right. You're right. Actually, it is a fairly new science in a way. I think everybody has always been talking about nutrition and nutrition for the brain and nutrition for the heart and nutrition for weight loss, but really the tools that are needed to understand brain function were not available to scientists for a very long time. I think it's been this past decade that medical breakthrough have allowed scientists to really understand and visualize what happens in the brain as a reaction to certain foods.
Right. It's just...
That's a theme we hear a lot about.
Yeah, especially recently. And in fact, just a couple weeks ago, we interviewed Dr. Stephen Mosley. I don't know if you're familiar with him. His book is called The Better Brain Solution. But both your research and his had this really clear connection to the way we eat and Alzheimer's and the onset of Alzheimer's.
People have shown that there are different forms of Alzheimer's, for sure. I can say historically and for clinical purposes, we usually distinguish two kinds of Alzheimer's. There's an early onset form that is caused by genetic mutations in the DNA, and then there's a late onset form that is not caused by genetic mutations but is influenced by a variety of genetic factors as well as lifestyle, which is perhaps the part that is a little bit more actionable, if you will. Actually, is very actionable.
Yes.
What I heard you say a moment ago Dr. Moscone, was that a lot of the technological breakthroughs that are allowing us to image and see into the brain and see what's happening in the brain has changed so dramatically over the last decade that we're now having a very large wave of new research looking at how food impacts the functioning of the brain, looking at, you know, all these associated processes that we've never been able to look at before. And we've heard that consistently in many interviews, that anything that has to do with the brain. And it is that one of the critical components of your research, is the ability to use technology and see what's happening in ways we were never able to do before?
Yes, for sure. For many years, the research on diet and brain aging and Alzheimer's was more correlational. So people would start identifying dietary patterns, let's say today, and then follow patients for many, many years until some develop cognitive decline, some progress to Alzheimer's and dementia, and then we would try to correlate the diet with the outcomes. And that's a little bit bypassing the brain in between, right? So the question, I think, is really, if I eat a certain way, what's going to happen in my brain now, rather than am I going to get Alzheimer's in 30 years from now? Me, personally, I would like to know today if I'm at risk for Alzheimer's, and if my diet is a possible factor that increases risk for myself, I need to know and I want to change it. So yes, brain imaging is a big part of my research. My background is in neuroscience and nuclear medicine, which is kind of code for brain imaging. So I've been doing this for like 15 years, and we use methods like MRI and positron emission tomography for PET to measure brain activity as well as presence of Alzheimer's pathology, like Alzheimer's plaques, immediately in the brains of our patients the minute they walk in the door.
I see that you have a degree in integrative nutrition, and you also started the Nutrition and Brain Fitness Lab at NYU Medical Center. And hearing you describe how diet impacts the function of our brain, can we call food medicine at this point, or are we getting closer to considering or thinking about food as medicinal versus just nutrition?
I think we should. I think we should as a society. If you think about it, I think it's interesting how intuitively we use food as medicine. When somebody's not feeling well, the first question is, oh, maybe I should have chicken soup for dinner. Or if you're feeling sad and depressed, maybe you'll have some ice cream or chocolate. And that's not because they taste good. That's because the foods we eat really change our moods, our emotions, our thoughts. And they also change the brain, the way the brain works. So I think as a society, we're very comfortable with the idea that we feed our bodies, but we're less aware that we feed our brains too, and that the foods we eat change not just the way we look, but also the way we think. So the research, so some foods will help us age gracefully and really maintain and achieve top mental performance, while other foods will have the opposite effect, harming our brains and also increasing risk of cognitive decline and dementia. And I think maybe a good way to put that is the same way that we would want to save for retirement, we should also start eating for retirement, in a way. It's really, it's about the long term. It's about our future.
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. Another good way to think of it is this fact that the brain uses 20 to 30% of the calories you consume, which is huge. And so the good news about this is I think that all of the dietary advice that you give and in your book, it's things that we already should know and we already should be practicing, but somehow it packs a much more powerful punch when it's related to our brain function. Maybe we should, start with the obvious ones like leafy greens. I mean, how long have we known that kale and Swiss chard is going to be so much better for us than iceberg lettuce, for example?
Yes, absolutely. Another nutrient, another food that most people underestimate, I think, is water.
Yes.
And especially in America, statistics show that most Americans are mildly dehydrated and just don't realize it. And another thing we don't realize is that the brain is mostly made of water, right? So over 80% of the brain's content is actually water. And every chemical reaction that takes place in the brain needs water to occur, even energy production. Without water, there would be no energy in the brain. What happens is that the brain is very sensitive to dehydration. So even a minimal loss of water, like a 2% reduction, which is not that much, can really cause neurological symptoms like brain fog, fatigue, dizziness, confusion, and even worse, brain shrinkage. Like brain imaging studies have shown that the brain literally shrinks when we don't drink enough water.
Well, I would agree with you that when people are dehydrated, that's when it's most obvious, that brain fog and not thinking clearly. And a lot of people, if they're pretty tuned into their bodies and their brains, will attribute it to, oh, I'm dehydrated, I need to drink some water, I need to clear my head. But thinking about it on a long-term effect of dehydration is pretty interesting. And I just wanted to mention that I have the page open in your book to someone who has eaten a Mediterranean diet their whole lives. And then someone it's the brain scans of a Western diet, more like an American diet, versus Mediterranean, like the diet you grew up on, eating dandelion greens. I love your stories about dandelion greens, for example. But wow, what a marked difference.
It is. And we have done many studies looking at the Mediterranean diet. It's not really the Mediterranean diet. It's more like similar to that. It would be like a high-carb diet with plenty of vegetables and fruits and enough fish and nuts and legumes and extra olive oil, I would say, instead of butter. So it's not, strictly speaking, it's not what you would find necessarily in Italy. Like, I don't think anybody here eats dandelion greens, but close enough. And if you compare people who follow that diet to those on a more typical Western diet, the results are very scary in many ways. Like you can see easily a 15% reduction in brain volume in those on a Western diet as a group. Of course, not everybody shows the same things. There are people who show more brain volume loss and more shrinkage and people who show less of that. But on average, as a group, those brains are just not doing well. And these are people who are like in their 40s and 50s.
Now, I heard you say a minute ago that there's a connection between brain health and aging gracefully, shall we say, a more aesthetically pleasing older age. And I'm wondering about that because not too long ago, life expectancy, I mean, if we go back thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years, we can get to a time where nobody worried about what they were going to look like when they got old because nobody got old.
when did
sort of the connection between an aesthetic appeal and high brain function, when did that common ground come into existence? Or am I misinterpreting something that you said? Because it seems like that could be a driver to eat well, to eat in a way that helps your brain function, increases your longevity, and allows you to age gracefully.
Yes, I think for many years, physicians just simply did not believe that nutrition had anything to do with brain aging or brain health. And I think it's something that's becoming more and more clear nowadays as research actually shows a very strong connection. Like even in my field, in the field of Alzheimer's disease, when I first started, most people understood Alzheimer's as an outcome of bad genes in your DNA or an outcome of aging or both. And that was maybe 15 years ago when I started. But in 2018, I think there is consensus that genes are not the destiny, and aging does not mean that you're going to get dementia. And there's so many other factors like diet, exercise, and intellectual stimulation are just equally important. And now scientists agree that at least one-third of all Alzheimer's cases could be prevented by improving your lifestyle, including your diet. So I think there's been a shift in the way that we're thinking about lifestyle and brain aging and dementia.
And then I also heard you reference very quickly olive oil, and that's something that gets some attention in your book. How is it that something as simple, well, not simple, but how is it that any one food, and take olive oil, can be packed with monounsaturated fatty acids, rich in vitamin E, and also packed with omega-3s, all in one area, in one place, in one source? How does that even happen?
Well, because nature is amazing, right? I think that some foods, you know, every food can be defined in terms of how nutritionally dense it is. And that's based on the nutritional composition. And that's also what led to the terminology of superfoods. It's not necessarily a medical term, but there are some foods that are better for you than others. And usually these are nutritionally packed foods. And in this case, olives are incredibly helpful. And olive oil, as a result, is a pretty incredible anti-aging food.
So should we be using olive oil at all times in our cooking whenever it calls for any sort of substance that does whatever olive oil does?
I think what's really important about olive oil is that it's a very delicate oil. Like you said, it's very rich in omega-3s from plants and also in vitamin E. And these are very delicate nutrients. They get very easily damaged and oxidized. So the best way to consume olive oil is unheated, or like we say in Italy, a crudo. Mm-hmm. You make your salad and you put olive oil on it. It should not be overheated. So it's actually the kind of oil that you don't want to use at very high temperature. There are other fats, there are other oils that can stand the heat a little more, like coconut oil, avocado oil. They have a much higher smoke point, so they don't burn as easily.
So, Dr. Moscone, it's not surprising at all that the top five foods to avoid are more like food groups, I would say, and they play a very large role in the American diet, in some of the American diet. Fast food, white sugar, white flour, soda, and processed meats. No surprise there. However, it does suggest that I might curtail my French fry habit a little bit more. The rest of the time, I promise
it's
I eat good food.
You know, like, it's not surprising that they're bad for you. What is surprising is that everybody eats them.
Right. Exactly.
Right?
I mean, all these groups, those five groups, if you have a diet made up of these, you feel terrible. And yeah. That's what you observed probably when you first came to this country.
I was in shock when I moved to, yes, I suffered. I have to be honest, my performance suffered enormously. And that's actually why when I first realized that my diet had really something to do with my mental capacities.
Well, when you give talks and lectures throughout the country and now you're promoting this book, what is the thing that you think helps the most in promoting, you know, just a switch of this diet away from fast food and white sugar and white flour? It would seem to me that simply suggesting that you'll think more clearly is quite compelling, quite a good sales job, right?
Well, I think people should pay attention, yes. I think everybody would be happy to improve their focus, attention, and memory and just think more clearly and be more efficient, especially in this day and age where everything moves so fast and you have to be on call 24 hours a day and you're always accountable. I think whatever we could do to just make sure that we are the healthiest versions of ourselves that we can be is worth it. And diet is really important and is one of the few things that we really have control over. So why not? You know, it's good to know that our destiny is on us in many ways.
I'm wondering if in your research for the book you ran across any aspects of diet that had to do with time of eating and also food combinations. We ran across this recently in an interview, and it was about trying to trick your body into going into a pseudo-fasting mode, which had very positive implications and consequences for brain activity, similar to eating healthy food, also depriving your body of calories, had a similar aspect to it.
We do that research, actually. So I'm the associate director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Center, and all our patients, actually technically not patients, they're asymptomatic people with a family history of Alzheimer's, and they receive custom-tailored and personalized interventions, if you will, that combine medical recommendations and also lifestyle recommendations. And part of the diet plan, usually, not for everybody, you know, everybody's different and everybody has different needs, but for those who can tolerate it, intermittent fasting is actually encouraged. And there are many ways to do that. One way that seems to be easy to follow for many patients is to practice overnight fasting. You like have an early dinner around 6, 7 p.m. and then refrain from eating until 9, 10 a.m. the day after. So you can go like either 12 hours without eating and then try to push it to 14 if you can tolerate that. And of course, during the day, you can't eat 3,000 calories, right? Otherwise that won't work. So it would be intermittent fasting in the context of a low-calorie diet overall, within reason.
Okay, I have to ask. So you can't ingest 3,000 calories the next day, but what if you go out and exercise and burn 3,500 calories the next day? Does that
sure.
work?
Well, then yes.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
How many people do that? How many people burn 3,000 calories when they exercise?
Just only one that I know of, and she's sitting right across from me, so.
Really? Oh, wow.
We do live in a town with a lot of outdoor activity going on and people who are quite obsessed about getting a lot of exercise. And actually, that's kind of an interesting point, is that oftentimes, and the reason that I allow myself French fries whenever I want is because I exercise so much and I do eat well and I pay attention to my diet.
Right.
But that's another thing that I think that we need to notch it up a bit, where we can eat anything we want because we are active. And I think that's a little bit of a trick that is played on the minds of some people who exercise a lot.
Well, I think quality of your food is very important regardless mm-hmm. of how much you exercise, right? Otherwise, you're kind of wasting time in a way. Like, you want to exercise and you want your diet to be healthy to really make sure that everything is under control.
Yes, absolutely. Talk for just a second before we let you go about berries.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yes, berries are an excellent brain food. They're packed with antioxidants that help keep memory sharp, especially as we get older. They're also a really good source of fiber and glucose, which is the main energy source for the brain. So they're sweet, but also have a low glycemic index, and they help regulate blood sugar levels. So they're really helpful. And, you know, everybody talks about blueberries, but blackberries actually have a much higher antioxidant potential than blueberries.
They're just a little harder to find for us.
Blackberries?
Yeah. Love blackberries.
Yeah, I love them too. They're just a little more difficult to find. Blueberries always seem to be everywhere during season, and blackberries a little less so often.
That's what I thought too.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I thought. And then I went on Fresh Direct and they have them all year long.
Yep, there you go. Just have to look for
them. I was really surprised. And actually, there's another kind of berry that is even better than blackberries, although they're hard to find. And they're amla, or the Indian gooseberry. I never found it. I have no idea where to find it, but technically, those are the best berries to eat.
We actually have gooseberries that grow wild here.
So, oh, that's wonderful. Do they taste good?
They do. They're wonderful. And I have to mention...
Oh, then I would definitely try that. Uh-huh.
I have to mention, because you talk about fish and the benefits of fish, and the one fish that you call out, I mean, you call out salmon and halibut, but there's another fish that you mentioned, bluefish, and you say it's cheap, and it's a type of mackerel. And you're right, it's cheap and it's a type of mackerel. And as a child, I fished for bluefish on the North Shore of Long Island for many years, and it was one of my favorite things to do. So I was thrilled to see the bluefish finally get the recognition it deserves.
Yes, and it's so good. It's so tasty. In Italy, it's very popular. It's a very popular fish.
A lot of people don't like it because it's oily and fishy. It has a very strong fish taste, and a lot of people like that milder fish taste for some reason. But I grew up loving bluefish.
I heard that. It's very strange. How culture can shape the way you think about flavors, no?
Yes.
Like, I never heard anyone in Italy say that a fish is too fishy.
Yeah.
Well, that's because you were raised on anchovies.
Yeah. Right, yes. After that, everything else is mild. Yes.
That's right. I just want to ask you a question before we let you go, Dr. Moscone, and thank you so much for joining us. But I'm wondering if when you return to your native Florence, if you're surprised or delighted or dismayed at some of the dietary changes in your home country at all.
It is changing. It is really changing. I was doing research for the book because it's going to come out in Italy as well, translated in Italian. And so we wanted to really talk about what's happening there. And I went to the supermarket. We were there for Christmas. And my friends also really were very happy to send me pictures and share information. A lot of people are eating processed food, mm-hmm. a lot more than when I was there. I left 15 years ago. There was hardly no processed food in supermarkets. And now instead they have to specify this is organic, this is not. And so many more people, they just don't have time to cook as much as my parents used to do or my grandparents used to do. And processed food is convenient. So it's really important that we raise awareness that, yes, it's convenient, but it comes with a price.
Yes, that's right. Well, Dr. Lisa Moscone, the book is Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Enjoy your berries and bluefish.
Thank you.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alf Engen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museum. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Details available at utaholympiclegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
Support for KPCW programming and American Roots is proudly sponsored in part by Donna Van Buren of the Van Buren Management Group and founder of Greater Park City Properties, managing HOAs since 1985. Information for Van Buren Management at 649-0652 or vanburenmgt.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Okay, so what's up with the 10,000 hours you have to spend to master something? Daunting, isn't it? Well, maybe a more optimistic attempt would be to micro-master. How about taking on things you feel passionate about and learning many things and learning them well enough to achieve a suitable and satisfying level of mastery? Robert Twigger is our guest. He is an author, adventure traveler, and apprentice micromaster. He lectures on risk management, polymathics, and leadership, and he's written a book. It's called Micromastery: Learn Small, Learn Fast, and Unlock Your Potential to Achieve Anything. He joins us now by phone. Welcome, Robert Twigger, to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for asking me.
I was just saying to Tim how I'm so happy to find out that I can actually be a micromaster. That 10,000 hours thing was really disconcerting to me because I have this feeling that in my life, at least, and I think it's the same for many people, you're never going to spend 10,000 hours doing these things that you would love to pursue. So thank goodness for you, Robert Twigger.
Well, it was partly that very same thought that spurred me on at the beginning, because when you sort of start breaking it down, even if you're spending 20 hours a week on mastering something, that's 10 years. And there's something kind of pessimistic about the fact that you're only going to be able to master one thing in your life. And I realized that actually you could master lots of things if you got to the kernel, a kind of distilled essence of the subject. And that's what the real idea of micromastery is, I suppose.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I would say that thinking of or having the thought in your mind that you're not going to master something unless you spend 10,000 hours might prevent a lot of people from even pursuing those sorts of thoughts.
Well, that was it. I mean, the idea that now when you're a kid, you get interested in something and then you just start doing it. You try and find some cool things to show off to other people. And that's really, I think that's a really normal way to learn. And this idea that I can't be interested in that because I obviously can't give it enough attention. And that feeling of being shut off and having to kind of walk down the street with blinkers on, I just really rebelled against that. And I thought, you know, it's a kind of human right to be able to be interested in anything and pursue and give yourself permission, really, to pursue those interests.
Well, Lynn and I both like anything that we can attach ourselves to that has mastery in it. So whether it's micro mastery or macro mastery, we'll go for it as long as somebody's telling us we're masters. But Robert, where do you, what's the line, or is there a line between what I would think you might hear from some people, and maybe you don't, maybe life is just wonderful, but maybe you hear from some people, hey, you know, this is really for the ADHD generation. This is for people who can't concentrate. This is for people who can't focus long enough to take on a project, and they need to break it down into little digestible bite-sized pieces that can hold their attention for brief periods of time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do hear that kind of thing. But basically, that stems from a wrong conception of learning. The idea that it's kind of like a stairway, it's a kind of school-type way of learning. In fact, it's much more holistic than that. And so, for example, when I asked, part of the project was asking experts what the micromastery in their field would be. So when I asked a carpenter and cabinet maker, he said making a perfect cube of wood. Now, it's quite easy to make a really bad cube of wood, but to make a perfect cube of wood is actually a very difficult thing to do. But all the skills in that are the ones that you need to do carpentry. So it's not like you make one step and then you forget it. So if that was school, you'd just make your cube, it'd be rubbish, and then you'd move on to something else. No, you keep going back to that thing again and again, and you're able to experiment with it, and that's what makes it different.
You know, you just said earlier that, you know, over the course of a lifetime, that 10,000 hours to master anything and how many years that would take of doing it in little bits and pieces, but this sort of comes at it in a similar fashion. I mean, over a period of time, when you're doing these cubes of wood or whatever it is that you're doing in this micro fashion, if you look back and add it all up, you're like, hey, you know, I've invested a significant amount of time in the various steps and look where I am now. Or am I missing something on that timeline?
No, I mean, take my example of the omelet. I thought, okay, I'm never going to be a great chef, but I'll do omelets. And I started talking to experts about omelets, and I, you know, watched videos and read recipe books. But I was able to cook an omelet every morning without it even making any impact or dent in my life. So it does add up, but it's not in the kind of painful, grinding, useless way. It's kind of adding up in a humorous way, an interesting way. But also, you can let it go whenever you want. So the point about a micromastery, for example, there's some in here. I had a go at, like, a kayak roll in a kayak, an Eskimo roll in a kayak. I'm not about to probably do that again. I'm just glad that I micromastered it, and I can leave it at that. But somebody else might take that and go further.
And are you now a better chef?
I'm pretty damn good at omelets, and it has fed into the other areas of cooking in lots of interesting ways. Like before I got into the omelet thing, I didn't realize that certain foods are much more susceptible to undercooking or overcooking, and that's just something. You know, I just thought, oh, don't burn things. That was my kind of general view before, but now I understand there's kind of a bit more subtlety involved.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, our guest is Robert Twigger. He's the author of a book called Micro Mastery, Learn Small, Learn Fast, and Unlock Your Potential to Achieve Anything. Well, and also, Robert, it would seem to me that you now are able to pursue things with a bit more confidence in the kitchen, say, that you micromastered the omelet, and maybe, you know, maybe there's confidence in other areas. And I think this is sort of gets at the essence of our desire to learn new things. A lot of it has to do with confidence. And it's funny, in our kitchen at home, there is someone in our family who's very good at making things in the pressure cooker, my spouse. And I think a lot of people avoid the pressure cooker because you're sort of scared that it's going to blow up. And
blow up.
Right, yeah. Right. And so he kept getting all these compliments from anyone who would come to our house and our children. You're the best cook. And I would sit on the sidelines thinking I'm really not good. And I don't know how to pursue the pressure cooker until one day I decided enough is enough. I'm going to micromaster the pressure cooker, and overall it's given me a great deal more confidence in the kitchen at this late age. Like, it really matters, right? But
it's certainly learning. One of the things that I uncovered in it is the fact that we really need to keep learning throughout life, and actually it's not just enough to just do a crossword. You know, actually learning as you get older is really essential for keeping your brain healthy.
Absolutely.
But to go back to the confidence thing, I think that that's a really essential thing. I think we're born confident, if you like, and then life kind of knocks away at it. So I think of confidence as a natural inheritance, and it's just about, micromastery is about taking away those obstacles that kind of debilitate us.
Absolutely. So a few minutes ago, you spoke about getting at the kernel of what it is you want to micromaster. What is that kernel?
Well, sometimes it means asking an expert, and they know about it. So I asked someone who worked for Madden Tussauds, which is this wax museum in London. They make these perfect wax models. And he said what they do when you start there is they give you a piece of clay or plasticine, and you just have to make a skull out of it. And then you carry it around in your pocket, and you're supposed to make funny skulls and long skulls and big skulls and small skulls. And it's like a small version that allows that experimentation. And I would say the kernel is any small self-contained skill that you can experiment with. Without it becoming boring, you can actually start tweaking the variable, and that's really how you keep your interest and learn.
You know, Robert, there was a term that you've used that I had to look up, and I like when that happens, but it was polymathics. Could you tell us about polymathics and your belief, how that plays in, and what you found with the Nobel scientists and their polymathic approach to things?
Yeah, that's a fascinating piece of research. The you'd think that Nobel Prize winners in the sciences would be the epitome of specialization, but it turns out that they're actually far more polymathic. They're kind of covert polymath, skilled in lots of different things, and they're between 22 and 25 times more likely to pursue an art or a craft, even doing magic tricks, photography, writing poetry, than a normal academic scientist. And these aren't people who just took it up after they won the Nobel Prize in their retirement. They pursued that throughout their lives. So I think there's a key there, that having additional intense kind of hobbies or micro masteries gives you another perspective and other ideas. I mean, some of the examples, they actually got ideas from other areas that they were masters of.
And Lynn's spouse, who uses the pressure cooker and gets accolades from everyone, would that be characterized as the term you used as the entry trick, that he's getting recognition?
Yeah, that's a perfect
recognition.
Yeah, pressure cooker is a brilliant entry trick because it's actually quite easy once you can get away from the pressure of using it.
That's great. So the entry trick is one of six sort of stages of the structure of MicroMastery. So maybe you could go through a couple of those at least. The rub, pat, barrier. Yeah. These are all very funny.
The rub, pat, barrier comes from the idea of, you know, when you're trying to pat your stomach and rub your head or vice versa, it seems really difficult to do at first. And then, of course, you manage it. And what I've discovered with learning things is that skills don't pile on top of we kind of expect skills to pile on top of each other and it all to be uniform. But sometimes a skill interferes with a previous skill. And you've just got to accept that. And if you know that's going to happen, you don't kind of lose heart and you can really focus on it. And so in certain areas, like, I don't know, climbing a rope, once you know that that it's not about hanging from the rope, it's about coordinating, mm-hmm. shifting your legs up and sort of gripping, that's kind of like the barrier that you can focus your mind on. Whereas most people, when they try and climb ropes, are just thinking about their poor old arms and dropping off that rope.
And then one of the things you say is it's not just, MicroMastering is not just taking an introductory course. Or, you know, 101. I think back when I took one semester of Russian, which is kind of laughable.
Yeah.
And then I never to repeat it again.
How much is retained?
Yeah, right. Nothing.
I mean, that is the common experience of a lot of things that are structured as an academic course. You do it, and then, you know, 5 years later, you can't retain a thing. Whereas a MicroMastery is something that you can have forever, and it's a kind of basic unit. So on the language front, one of the examples I've included is learning the Marseillaise, the French national anthem, and you can learn it from singing along to the extract from Casablanca, which is on YouTube. And if you could master that, it's not that difficult, and I include the words, every French person will be amazed.
Yeah, absolutely. And we want those French people to be amazed by us.
Oh, we do.
We simple
absolutely.
Anglos.
So, Robert, you've talked about optimism and pessimism, and I think that's a really interesting way to frame this. And, you know, putting 10,000 hours into mastering something is a path you assert that could be a path toward pessimism. And MicroMastery, on the other hand, you assert, don't make the scientific claim, but the assertion that can actually be a path toward optimism. How does that work?
I think that when you're young, you have permission to be interested in everything. And as you get older, you deny yourself permission to be interested in lots of things. And that's fine. Let's say you are, they did a survey and discovered that only 3.6% of the population are natural specialists. The rest of us, 96% of us, actually naturally inclined to being interested in more than one thing. And if you are naturally interested in more than one thing, then you should want to be able to be able to pursue lots of different things. So I think the idea of optimism is that the world is an abundant place and the future is an interesting and exciting place. But if you're only doing one thing, it's kind of like tunnel vision. The future doesn't look very great. I'm not saying it's for everybody, but MicroMastery definitely is for people who feel that they're having to say no more than they're saying yes, because I think we want to say yes.
Yes, we do. Yes. I'm so glad, Robert, that you give the example of surfing, stand-up surfing. And I thought we might just, you know, go into a few of the things that you go through in your book. You know, things like brewing craft beer, which has fascinated me that people do this. But surfing standing up is a good one because in addition to the pressure cooker, my spouse is very good at surfing. And I figure, you know, again, at this point in my life, I probably won't learn. So I stay on the shoreline and
you're spending a lot of time on the sidelines. Seems very unlike you. This is not the Lynn Ware Peak I know.
Well, yeah. So take me through, you know, how I'm going to learn surfing standing up.
Well, surfing standing up, I mean, the big thing is when you get out in the water, you practice a few times getting up on the board and you get tired out and then you lose interest and heart. So get a foam board, because a foam board is one that won't hurt you when it hits you in the water, mm-hmm. and put it on your bed and practice jumping up on the board on your bed, because the bed is a little bit wobbly. And once you can do that and you've built up those specific muscles, you'll be just much more confident when you go out there. And surfing is one thing where you can take a 1 or 2 day course, which will help you get through that confidence barrier. But you don't have to. But that foam board and practicing jumping up on the bed, that's really the entry trick.
That is such a great, great tip. I love that.
Robert, what is punk micro mastery?
Well, that came from the punk rock kind of art movement, in a way, which occurred in the UK, where basically people who couldn't play their instruments very well suddenly said, well, why don't we just be pop stars anyway? And people who hadn't been to art school said, why don't we just do comics? And that kind of feeling of just getting out there and doing it. And, of course, some of the music they turned out was quite good. And sometimes sitting for hours and hours learning something isn't as useful as actually trying to go out and do it. So I feel that there's a kind of a kinship there between micromastery and that sort of energy that the punk rock movement exemplified.
Is your book intended to be a self-help book? Because, I mean, after you give all the examples of things that you can do as, you know, exercises and micromastery, then you have the whole section about micromaster your life. So I'm curious as to how you view this work. Is it, what are you attempting to accomplish with your audience?
What I'm hoping is that people will get what they can out of the book. If they just want to learn a few new skills, then that's great. If they want to take it further, because I believe that all these things are linked together, and that by learning things, you actually start releasing a kind of a greater interest in life and the world, and it sort of implies that we're not kind of narrow beings. You know, the bigger idea behind micromastery is polymathy, the idea that we are multi-talented people. And so that's what the last bit is an attempt to try and persuade or encourage people that they are not a kind of broken specialist. They are actually a polymath and capable of doing lots of different things.
And how do you see that fitting into kind of what's happening on a global scale these days? Does, you know, are you fighting a bit of a tide, or is this something that actually aligns with what's happening around the world in politics and countries?
Well, certainly, if you want to succeed on the surface, you have to pretend to be a specialist. But all specialists need to refresh their field from other areas. So you have to be a kind of covert polymath. That's what the Nobel Prize winners are doing. On the surface, they appear all kind of specialized, but actually they've got all these other interests. So I'm saying, okay, if the world is tending towards greater and greater specialization, accept that, go with it, but then realize if you want to rise to the top, you're going to have to be a covert polymath.
The example of Esther Ledecker in the recent Winter Olympics winning gold in both snowboard and the Super G, obviously she's learned to master various things, you know, several things at a time. But, you know, one of the things she said in her post-winning interviews was that she didn't want that early specialization. She didn't want to be told that she had to just stick with skiing or snowboarding. And I think that's really fascinating. There is sort of a growing movement, especially around children in sport, to, you know, sort of rebel against this early specialization.
Yeah, I think that it is I've noticed it amongst, my kids are 16 and 18, and I've noticed that they're more willing to have a go at lots of different things and actually show skill in lots of different areas than I think people of my age, when we were younger, we tended to sort of self-identify as one particular thing more.
You know, and Lynn, in that post winning of the Super G interview, she said that she felt her competitors had felt too much pressure from their specialization in their field, and she didn't share any of that pressure, which freed her to ski in a different way, which I think, Robert, is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a really good point, yeah, because you have a different perspective, and so, yeah, that you don't have those same intense worries that over-specialized people have. And I think that's a big part of it. In the modern world, we are very stressed and anxious. So anything that relieves that is a good thing.
I'm wondering how your structure would tie into the musician. It seems to me always that musicians, you know, maybe they start off playing the piano, but then they have no problem picking up the guitar and the harmonica and the drums. And that has always fascinated me, not being a musician myself.
Oh, you're on the sidelines with that one also?
Yes, I think, yeah, music particularly lends itself. I was thinking about scales. My daughter is just about to do a music exam, and she's getting bored with scales. And so I said, just do them to particular rhythms, you know, to funny or humorous rhythms. So you get an experimental element in doing scales. And so that kind of turns the scale from something that's static into a micromastery, because it's both repeatable and also has an experimental element. And I think that with music, I mean, one of the things in the book is about finding your own way into a subject and finding what's fun about something. So when you say you pick up violin, you might think the fun way of playing a violin is the kind of gypsy style, you know, with a bit more of a casual air to it than the sort of classical pose. And if that works for you, then that can be your way in. Doesn't mean that you stick with it forever, but that I think is quite important.
Well, Robert Twigger, I'm so glad you could join us this morning. The book is Micro Mastery: Learn Small, Learn Fast, and Unlock Your Potential to Achieve Anything. It is a wonderful new take for me. I love it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of The Mountain Life. Are you reluctant or worried about having a total knee or shoulder replacement? We offer an array of non-surgical and surgical alternatives. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Rimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hi, it's me, John Burdick, Assistant Program Director here at KPCW.
And me, DJ Riley.
And your pal Dave from the all-new Dave Show.
We need recruits for our KPCW Volunteer Air Force.
Volunteers ready and willing to give their time as on-air DJs.
Now is the time to join our ranks.
We're always looking for folks who love music.
And want to be part of our community radio station.
Just send an email to john@kpcw.org and you'll be on the way.
We want you.
Now.
Slight chance of rain and snow showers this afternoon with a high near 53 tonight. Again, showers before midnight. Chance of precipitation only 40% tonight. Friday, snow before noon, then a chance of snow showers afternoon with a high of 47. As a matter of fact, there's rain and or snow in the forecast all the way through the weekend. So be ready for that. Right now, we've had a few snow showers this morning here in Old Town. Cleared up right now for the moment. 38 degrees in Old Town. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Time to go to NPR News.
Of cancers affecting both men and women, colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the United States. But it doesn't have to be. I'm Dr. Rick Craig, gastroenterologist at University of Utah Healthcare's Redstone Clinic. Colon cancer is preventable with early screening. If you are 50 or older, get screened. For more information, visit redstone.uofuhealth.org. University of Utah Healthcare is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Rudy on the radio coming up following the news from NPR. That's coming up in about 20 seconds from right now. Again, for the weekend, there's a chance of snow Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.